Malika Malik, the Belgian wife of Abdessattar Daman, one of Massoud's assassins, wrote a self-published book in French about her husband's experiences in Afghanistan called Soldiers of Light. It recounts the story of how a Western woman and her Tunisian husband traveled from Belgium to Afghanistan, beguiled by bin Laden's message and his charismatic appeal. Excerpts of Soldiers of Light follow. The story of my husband and myself is one of a religious Muslim couple to which history threw up an unexpected act. My husband killed the famous Massoud, the Lion of Panjshir, who had faced down the Russian army. But what pushed us to leave the comfort of a European country to go and share life with the Afghan people under the Taliban regime? On the 9th of September 2001, a Sunday, an audacious 39-year-old Tunisian transformed himself into a kamikaze along with an accomplice who was 28. In the manner of the Palestinians, they exploded a bomb hidden in the belt of the younger of the two, but there was also a second bomb hidden in the camera, which appeared to be recording an interview with the chief opposition to the Taliban commander Massoud, but in reality was going to kill the Lion of Panjshir. One of the two small kamikazes died on the spot, and the other was taken down by bullets. It was the latter that was designated by the media the instigator of the crime. He was a criminal for some, but he was a hero for the oppressed people of the Third World, who took hope that they could now be listened to and treated with a bit more respect and not just be manipulated according to the interests of the powerful of the planet. This hero was my husband, Abdessattar. And so passed the days while I was living in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, until the 12th of September 2001. When I crossed the street, a Pakistani woman addressed me in Arabic. I hardly understand the few words she says that make my heart freeze. I went to the mosque to the brother that my husband had entrusted me to. "What has happened to Abdessattar? This woman says he is dead." He lowers his head. He doesn't want to talk about it in the street. A few minutes later, he comes to my house, and from behind the door, he says, "Yes, it's true. Abdessattar is dead." We both could not stop crying. Apparently, everybody knew that my husband was dead, but the agreement was not to tell me, because my husband had recorded an audio cassette for me in which he announced his death to me himself. He had not wanted me to find out from somebody else. At that time, I descended into deep depression. When the threat of a war by the Americans was announced, I didn't care if all the bombs in the world were to fall on me. They did not leave me alone during this period. Ironically, it was the time when the Afghans were celebrating the death of Massoud, and dozens of Afghan women and non-Afghans came to congratulate me on what my husband had done. I eventually received this cassette that my husband had left for me to say a final goodbye, a final "I love you." I hoped to find the reason for his action, but there is none. I won't reveal the contents of the tape. Abdessattar would have wanted our last words to be between him and me. He told me he would love me to the end of my days. The brother who came to drop the audio tape handed an envelope to me and said, "This is Osama bin Laden that is sending this to you, and here is $500 that he is giving you to reimburse the debt of your husband." I thanked him, but I did not understand why I had received an envelope from Osama bin Laden. Malika Malik expanded in an interview on what she had written in her book. It wasn't a great amount of money from bin Laden. It was to repay a small debt. The money was not for me. We Muslims cannot die and leave debts. So when we make a will, we write the debts that we owe. When the person dies and it is found that they have debts, then their debts must be repaid. My husband had had a debt of $500 to somebody for several years. Apparently Osama knew this, and this was a service he was rendering. If I had a debt, I would have to let the person closest to me know in case I were to die. We can't have debts. It's very important. I didn't meet the family of Osama bin Laden, but he, Osama, was there in Jalalabad. He was at a base. People spoke a lot about him. In every family, the firstborn was called Osama. He was loved because he was combating injustice. He wanted to liberate the Islamic lands. That was the opinion of everyone. He was rich, he had money, and he put his money at the service of his community and to spend it on others. That is worthy of being respected and loved. It's not everybody who does this. It's normal that we love him and he is a hero for us, a big brother, and the one who is calling out for Islamic resistance against occupation. My husband, Abdesitar, never spoke to me about his meeting with Osama. I know only what people told me afterwards. They told me that he had met Osama and that he gave him allegiance, that he put himself under bin Laden's orders. Yusuf al-Ayiri took control of al-Qaeda's operations in the Gulf region in late 2002. He was on the Saudi government's most wanted list and was killed in Riyadh in May 2003. Voice of Jihad, an al-Qaeda magazine in Saudi Arabia, printed his biography. This excerpt deals with al-Qaeda's role in and reaction to Massoud's assassination. Afterwards, the greatest event in Afghan history occurred, the assassination of the despicable commander Ahmed Shah Massoud, and there was no describing Sheikh al-Ayiri's joy. I remember asking him what happened, and he replied by saying that Sheikh Osama asked the brothers, who will take it upon himself to deal with Ahmed Shah Massoud for me, because he harmed Allah and his sons. A few brothers volunteered to assassinate Massoud and be rewarded by Allah. And you heard the good news. Feroz Ali Abbasi is the Ugandan Briton who was captured in Pakistan after the fall of the Taliban. An excerpt of his prison memoir follows. The significant event was the death of Massoud. We got wind from the brothers, then listened to the radio. Massoud had been taken out by a martyrdom operation. The Arab Mujahideen were responsible. When this happened, I thought that at last the Taliban were going to take the whole of Afghanistan. Massoud was crucial to the Northern Alliance. He was a highly skilled general. I was so touched by the event that I went to Saif al-Adl, al-Qaeda's number two military commander, in his office. I was nervous but wanted to put my request in. I said to him, I heard about Massoud being killed by a martyrdom operation. I would like to do something like that. For example, martyrdom operation against a military target. He said, did you like the operation against Massoud? I said, yes. Abu Anas, the Algerian who fought alongside Massoud for 8 years during the jihad against the communists. I swear to Allah, Massoud is the clearest, the purest mujahid inside Afghanistan. The purest Islamists are not extremists. But Massoud is an Islamist, a very deep Islamist, but not an extremist. Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist who covered both bin Laden and Massoud during the Afghan war against the communists. Massoud was very pragmatic. And maybe Massoud is the future of the Islamic movement. Pragmatic Muslims can make success, but rigid Muslims do not succeed because they will just keep on fighting left, right, and center. I met Massoud in Kabul in the first week after he captured Kabul in 1992. And I fell in love with him just like everybody else. He was truly an astonishing guy. I wish that Osama met Massoud. Maybe if Osama met Massoud, it could have changed the course of history. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the key operational planner of the 9/11 attacks, spent his childhood and adolescence in Kuwait. He joined the Muslim Brotherhood at age 16 and, after attending college in the United States, traveled to Pakistan and then Afghanistan for jihad against the Soviets. In 1996, he met bin Laden in Tora Bora, Afghanistan, long after their first encounter during the Afghan jihad. It was then that Sheikh Mohammed presented a proposal for an operation that would involve training pilots who would crash planes into buildings in the United States. On March 1, 2003, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was arrested in Rawalpindi, Pakistan, near Islamabad, and was subsequently transferred to U.S. custody. He remains held at an undisclosed location. excerpts of the 9/11 Commission's profile of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or KSM, follow. KSM continued to travel among the worldwide jihadist community after Ramzi Youssef's arrest in 1995, visiting the Sudan, Yemen, Malaysia, and Brazil in 1995. No clear evidence connects him to terrorist activities in those locations. In January 1996, well aware that U.S. authorities were chasing him, he fled to Afghanistan. Just as KSM was re-establishing himself in Afghanistan in mid-1996, bin Laden and his colleagues were also completing their migration from Sudan. Through Atef, KSM arranged a meeting with bin Laden in Tora Bora, a mountainous redoubt from the Afghan war days. At the meeting, KSM presented the al-Qaeda leader with a menu of ideas for terrorist operations. According to KSM, this meeting was the first time he had seen bin Laden since 1989. Although they had fought together in 1987, bin Laden and KSM did not yet enjoy an especially close working relationship. Indeed, KSM has acknowledged that bin Laden likely agreed to meet with him because of the renown of his nephew, Youssef, who masterminded the first attack on the Trade Center in 1993. At the meeting, KSM briefed bin Laden and Atef on the first World Trade Center bombing. KSM also presented a proposal for an operation that would involve training pilots who would crash planes into buildings in the United States. This proposal eventually would become the 9/11 operation. KSM knew that the successful staging of such an attack would require personnel, money, and logistical support that only an extensive and well-funded organization like al-Qaeda could provide. He thought the operation might appeal to bin Laden, who had a long record of denouncing the United States. From KSM's perspective, bin Laden was in the process of consolidating his new position in Afghanistan while hearing out others' ideas, and had not yet settled on an agenda for future anti-U.S. operations. At the meeting, bin Laden listened to KSM's ideas without much comment, but did ask KSM formally to join al-Qaeda and move his family to Afghanistan. KSM declined. He preferred to remain independent and retain the option of working with other Mujahideen groups still operating in Afghanistan. According to KSM, the 1998 bombings of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam marked a watershed in the evolution of the 9/11 plot. KSM claims these bombings convinced him that bin Laden was truly committed to attacking the United States. He continued to make himself useful, collecting news articles and helping other al-Qaeda members with their outdated computer equipment. Bin Laden, apparently at Atef's urging, finally decided to give KSM the green light for the 9/11 operation sometime in late 1998 or early 1999. KSM then accepted bin Laden's standing invitation to move to Kandahar and work directly with al-Qaeda. In addition to supervising the planning and preparations for the 9/11 operation, KSM worked with and eventually led al-Qaeda's media committee. But KSM states he refused to swear a formal oath of allegiance to bin Laden, thereby retaining a last vestige of his cherished autonomy. At this point, late 1998 to early 1999, planning for the 9/11 operation began in earnest. Yet while the 9/11 project occupied the bulk of KSM's attention, he continued to consider other possibilities for terrorist attacks. During the summer of 2001, KSM approached bin Laden with the idea of recruiting a Saudi Arabian Air Force pilot to commandeer a Saudi fighter jet and attack the Israeli city of Eilat. Bin Laden reportedly liked this proposal, but he instructed KSM to concentrate on the 9/11 operation first. KSM appears to have been popular among the al-Qaeda rank and file. He was reportedly regarded as an effective leader, especially after the 9/11 attacks. Co-workers describe him as an intelligent, efficient, and even-tempered manager who approached his projects with a single-minded dedication that he expected his colleagues to share. Yosri Fuda, Al Jazeera's chief investigative reporter, never met with bin Laden, but he is the only reporter to have interviewed Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin Asheba, the operational planners of the 9/11 attacks. Fura met them both in the spring of 2002 in Karachi, Pakistan, where they laid out the details of the 9/11 plot. Much of what they volunteered to Fura was later confirmed by the 9/11 Commission report. Yosri Fura. I walk upstairs. I make my way upstairs with my intermediary, who drove me from outside Karachi. I counted four floors as I was walking upstairs. I hear a doorbell ringing, and then he started taking my blindfolds off. I opened my eyes. It took me a while to get used to the place. I counted four rooms, including the kitchen. And in one of the rooms inside, there was another guy sitting on the floor surrounded by laptops and mobile phones. By then, I started to get the idea, but I was not absolutely sure. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed asked me, "Have you recognized us yet?" I said, "You look familiar." I knew by then who they were. They told me the whole story. Khalid said that between 2.5 years and 3 years before the zero hour, 9/11, they held some meetings within Al-Qaeda's military committee and discussed planning and executing an operation against some American targets on American soil. They sent some reconnaissance units into the United States to study some recommended targets on the ground. He threw a heavyweight punch at me at the very beginning when he said that they did consider striking at a couple of nuclear facilities. And he said that later they decided to take it off the list because they were not sure if they could control the operation. They said, having studied the targets on the ground, that the White House was initially on the list, but they decided that it be taken off the list for navigation reasons. Apparently it was difficult to hit it from the air, according to them. And it was later replaced by another spectacular target, Capitol Hill. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is a very shrewd man. He knows very well what he's after, very much aware of security. And he is very much an operational man rather than a man of religion. For instance, when it was time for prayers, in Islam usually the eldest would lead the rest in the prayer. And although Ramzi bin Sheba was younger than Khalid, he is about 8 years his junior, he was leading us in the prayers. That tells you that Ramzi is really a man of religion, and he struck me as such. Khalid is not. Khalid is very much a man of operations, a man of action. He is very restless. Yes, he is a Muslim, and he prays, and he is the son of a preacher in Kuwait. But he didn't strike me as a man of religion. Nobody knows exactly the timing when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed decided to ally with bin Laden. But it would seem to me that it was around the time of 96-97 that Khalid found in bin Laden some sort of a mentor, a religious umbrella under which he could express his operational skills. When the so-called Bojinka operation to bring down a dozen U.S. airliners in Asia failed, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed looked around, and the year after, in 1996, bin Laden moved to Afghanistan. Bin Laden needed someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Bin Laden is the symbol of Al-Qaeda, the sheikh, the ultimate boss of Al-Qaeda. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is the guy who gets things going. He has a very long, solid experience in this. In 1995, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed tried to execute a spectacular operation, a mini 9/11 at the time, with a dozen American airliners in Asia and crashing them. It failed, but the dream of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed never faded. He's very much an operational man, in short. He likes being on top of a certain operation, directing people here and there, thinking of targets and stuff. It's, in a sense, also a game. He puts it in a religious context. When I arrived first to that safe house in Karachi, I said, "They say that you are terrorists." Khalid said, "Yes, they are right. We are terrorists. We like to terrorize disbelievers." It doesn't surprise me that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed organized 9/11. It's not exactly bin Laden's territory. He's not very fond of details, looking at details. He's the enigma. He's the chairman of the company, so to speak. He is the symbol of the organization. He would still need people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to be advising him on certain operations. And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed would, in turn, need people to execute things. What follows are excerpts from Fura's documentary, The Road to September 11th, which was broadcast on Al Jazeera on the first anniversary of the attacks. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and bin Sheba's subsequent statements to U.S. interrogators, which are reflected in the 9/11 Commission report, track closely with what they said in Fura's documentary. Ramzi bin Asheba. As for your questions about coordination of the 9/11 attacks, it is simply a process of interconnecting various cells, establishing a line of contact between these cells and the general command in Afghanistan, as well as following up on work priorities of these cells until all phases of preparation are complete, up to the moment of execution. I spoke with Brother Ziad Jarrah, one of the pilots in the 9/11 attacks, and asked him, "How do you feel?" He said, "My heart is at ease, and I feel that the operation will, inshallah, God willing, be carried out." In late January 2001, what the 9/11 pilots now needed were more flying hours, more training on simulators of large commercial planes such as Boeing 747 and 767, as well as studying the security precautions in all airports. One of the times, brothers Marwan and Ziad, two of the 9/11 pilots, were tailed by security officers throughout their reconnaissance flight from New York to California. But God was with them. The lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta, used to assure us that we shall one day meet. He always said, "Do not be saddened. We shall soon meet in paradise by the will of God." I told him that if he was to see the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and reach the highest place in heaven, he should convey our salam, greetings, to him. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. The so-called muscle hijackers who were not the pilots knew they were in for a martyrdom operation. But to prevent any leakage of information, they were not informed of many details. We told them that Brother Abu Abdul Rahman, the lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta, would provide them with details at a later stage. Ramzi bin Asheba. Shortly before the 9/11 attacks, Mohammed Atta told me in an Egyptian dialect, "A friend of mine gave me a puzzle I am unable to solve, and I want you to help me out." I said to him, "Is this time for puzzles, Mohammed?" He said, "Yes, I know, but you are my friend, and no one else but you can help me." He said, "Two sticks, a dash, and a cake with a stick down. What is it?" I said, "You wake me up to tell me this puzzle?" As it turns out, sticks is the number 11. A dash is dash, and a cake with a stick down is the number 9. And that was September 11th. Outside the United States, the date September 11th is written 11-9, rather than 9/11. These were very apprehensive moments. You are going into an unconventional battle against the most powerful force on earth. You are facing them on their land, among their forces and soldiers. You fight with a small group of 19 hijackers. This is not just a single hijacking operation, but four. It was crucial that all were executed simultaneously, and that all the brothers are on the flights at the same time. And it is crucial to consider the first 15 minutes as the golden opportunity to take control of the aircraft and steer it toward its target. The day of the attack, all camps and residential compounds in Afghanistan were put on high alert. Brothers were dispersed. The message was great news for Sheikh Abu Abdallah bin Laden. May God protect him. When they found out, the brothers shouted, "Allahu Akbar," thanks to God, and cried. Everyone thought that this was the only operation, the attack on the first World Trade Center tower. We said to them, "Wait, wait." Suddenly, our brother Marwan, the pilot, was violently ramming the plane into the Trade Center in an unbelievable manner. We were watching live and praying, "God, aim, aim, aim." Immediately after the Al Jazeera documentary aired, Ramzi bin Asheba was arrested in Karachi, Pakistan, on September 11, 2002, and was then transferred to U.S. custody. The U.S. Department of Justice provided summaries of the interrogations of Ramzi bin Asheba to German prosecutors in May 2005 for a terrorism case in Hamburg, These summaries show that it was a chance encounter on a train in Germany in 1999 that led the key 9/11 plotters to travel not to Chechnya to perform jihad, as they had originally planned, but rather to Afghanistan, where they would fatefully meet with al-Qaeda's top leaders, including bin Laden, and from there they would start down the road to implementing the 9/11 attacks 2 years later. Excerpts of what the Department of Justice provided to the Hamburg court follow. The following comments come entirely from Ramzi bin Asheba and may have been meant to influence as well as to inform. Bin Asheba may also have been intentionally withholding information and employing counter-interrogation techniques. Bin Asheba stated that his initial contact with Muhammad Ould Slahi, also known as Abu Musab al-Mauritania, occurred in late October or early November 1999 by telephone. Bin Asheba had been given Abu Musab's name and telephone number by a man named Khalid al-Masri, whom Bin Asheba met while traveling via train in Germany with Marwan al-Shehi and Ziad Jarrah, two of the 9/11 pilots. Bin Asheba reported that the meeting on the train was entirely by chance, and that Khalid probably approached them because they were bearded and had Gulf Arab appearances. Abu Musab gave Bin Asheba a date and told him to travel to Duisburg, Germany, for a personal meeting, which Bin Asheba, Ziad, and Marwan did about 2 or 3 days later. Bin Asheba said the train ride from Hamburg to Duisburg was about 3 or 4 hours, and Abu Musab met them at the train station. After hearing about their desire to travel to Chechnya, Abu Musab discussed the difficulties of traveling to that country and of the dangers individuals faced in traveling by way of Georgia, a country abutting Chechnya. According to Abu Musab, many travelers were arrested and held at will by the local authorities in Georgia. Bin Asheba stated that at this point, Abu Musab began to convince the group that it would be in their best interest to travel to Afghanistan. According to Bin Asheba, Abu Musab told them that the best route to Chechnya was via Afghanistan, where they would get the necessary training for the jihad and have a chance to meet other jihadists who had been to Chechnya. Abu Musab indicated that it would eventually be possible for the group to travel onward to Chechnya. Bin Asheba said they were initially suspicious of Abu Musab, but came to trust him as the meeting progressed. Abu Musab told them that the first step was to get Pakistani visas, as Pakistan would serve as their point of entry for onward travel to Afghanistan. He instructed them to apply for the visas using their authentic passports and to return in a specific period of time. Bin Asheba was unsure how much time passed between the first and second meetings, but estimated it was approximately 2 or 3 weeks. Bin Asheba said that although Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker, did not attend the meetings, he also decided to go to Afghanistan. They each applied for and acquired a 30-day Pakistani visa. Atta got his visa in Berlin. Marwan went to the United Arab Emirates to get his visa, and Bin Asheba and Ziad acquired their visas in Frankfurt, Germany. In approximately November 1999, once the group had obtained their visas, they called Abu Musab, who instructed them to travel again to Duisburg. Abu Musab was waiting for the group upon their arrival at the train station and brought them to his house. Once he confirmed that they had received their Pakistani visas, he instructed them to travel to Karachi, Pakistan, and from there to Quetta, Pakistan. Bin Asheba clarified that the group made the trip to Afghanistan between mid-November 1999 and December 1999. Ali Hamza Ahmad Suleiman al-Balul, a Yemeni, is accused of serving in al-Qaeda's media office and as bin Laden's bodyguard at the time of the 9/11 attacks. Excerpts from his Guantanamo charge sheet describe what was allegedly happening in al-Qaeda's camps around the time of 9/11. After being placed on alert by Osama bin Laden in the weeks just before the attacks of September 11, 2001, al-Balul assisted Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda members in mobilizing and moving from Kandahar in southern Afghanistan. On September 11, 2001, Osama bin Laden tasked al-Balul to set up a satellite connection so that bin Laden and other al-Qaeda members could see news reports. Despite his efforts, al-Balul was unable to obtain a satellite connection because of mountainous terrain. In the weeks immediately following the attacks of September 11, 2001, Osama bin Laden tasked al-Balul to obtain media reports concerning the September 11th attacks and to gather data concerning the economic damage caused by these attacks. Both prior to and after the attacks of September 11, 2001, al-Balul served as a bodyguard and provided protection to Osama bin Laden. From late 2000 until November 2001, al-Balul routinely traveled in a caravan of vehicles with Osama bin Laden. While traveling, al-Balul was armed and wore an explosives-laden belt so that he could provide Osama bin Laden with physical security and protection. Feroz Ali Abbasi describes his surprise that there was no American action against bin Laden, given that it was common knowledge around al-Qaeda's camps that an attack against the United States was imminent. Bin Laden was in a country that was favorable to him and his people. He was always surrounded by people, and although he took precautions like bodyguards, strangers, people he did not know, could actually come close enough on occasions to shake his hand. It's BS that Osama bin Laden hid in super-tech caves all over Afghanistan. Where are the caves? There are none. Where were America's, in fact, the world's special agents on the ground in Afghanistan? They must have been there, but yet they did not catch wind that Osama bin Laden was planning an attack on an American target. This information being so commonly known amongst everybody in the training camps. What was stopping them, the Americans, from assassinating bin Laden? Was it the fact that because Osama bin Laden was surrounded by his own people, that would have meant sacrificing one American life for thousands? Abu Musab al-Suri, the Syrian jihadist who had sometimes clashed with bin Laden. In September 2001, bin Laden told his followers that it was time to leave Afghanistan and go back to Yemen. As rumors, astonishment, and hope of this change spread among the Arab Afghans, the 11th of September explosions occurred. Saif Adel, al-Qaeda's present military commander. The goals of the New York strike. Since its establishment and independence from the British Crown, and for more than two centuries of human history, the United States has gone on the rampage everywhere in the world. It was intimidating and assaulting people. It was seizing the resources of nations. Some people might be surprised if we tell them that the United States was preparing its armada to occupy Algeria in 1817. Mujahideen and Arab sailors in the Mediterranean, whom the West labeled as the Barbary Pirates, confronted and defeated the U.S. fleet. The battles between the U.S. and Islamic parties lasted for more than 3 months. Our main objective, therefore, was to deal a strike to the head of the snake at home, to smash its arrogance. This objective was partially achieved, thank God. Had the other strikes succeeded the way the strike against the Twin Towers did, the world would have felt the sudden change. Our ultimate objective of these painful strikes against the head of the serpent was to prompt it to come out of its hole. This would make it easier for us to deal consecutive blows to undermine it and tear it apart. It would foster our credibility in front of our nation and the beleaguered people of the world. A person will react randomly when he receives painful strikes on his head from an undisclosed enemy. Such strikes will force the person to carry out random acts and provoke him to make serious and sometimes fatal mistakes. This was what actually happened. The first reaction was the invasion of Afghanistan, and the second was the invasion of Iraq. The mistakes might happen over and again, and there might be other random reactions. Such reactions prompted the Americans and their allies to deal powerful strikes to the head and other important parts of the body of our nation, which has been in hibernation for almost two centuries. God willing, these strikes will help the nation to wake from its slumber. Abdul Aziz Al-Omari, a Saudi from Asir province, together with Mohammed Atta and three other terrorists, boarded American Airlines Flight 11 at Boston's Logan International Airport on the morning of September 11th. At 8:45 a.m., American Flight 11 crashed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. The following are excerpts of Al-Omari's videotaped will, which was broadcast by Al Jazeera on September 10th, 2002. I am writing this will and do not know where I should begin. Ideas are accumulating in my mind. This is a message to all the infidels and to America. The message is, leave the Arabian Peninsula defeated and stop supporting the coward Jews in Palestine. We will continue to seek your death and humiliation, so long as the Book of God and the teachings of Prophet Muhammad are in our hands. I would like to particularly mention Mujahid leader Sheikh Osama bin Laden. May God protect him from the plots of the plotters, the envy of the envious ones, and the rancor of the rancorous ones. May God add these deeds to his balance of good deeds. Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker, left a copy of his own will in some baggage that was recovered at Boston's Logan Airport after the 9/11 attacks. An excerpt follows. Those who wash my body must be good Muslims. He who washes my body around my genitals should wear gloves so that I am not touched there. Of course, Atta's body was atomized in the 9/11 attacks. There was no body to wash or bury. No one should cry for me, scream or tear his clothes and beat his face. Those are foolish gestures. Neither pregnant women nor unclean people should say goodbye to me. I reject that. Women must not be present at my funeral or go to my grave at any later date. This was the exchange between ABC News correspondent John Miller, who had interviewed bin Laden in Afghanistan in May 1998, and ABC News anchor Peter Jennings at 10:29 a.m. on September 11, 2001. Miller: the North Tower seems to be coming down. Jennings: oh, my God. Miller: the second tower. Jennings: a very long pause. It's hard to put it into words. And maybe one doesn't need to. Both trade towers, where thousands of people work on this day, Tuesday, have now been attacked and destroyed, with thousands of people either in them or in the immediate area adjacent to them.